Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Tobacco companies used to basically rule America. They had the backing of the governments, both the federal and state governments. But then smoking became subjected to numerous restrictions. Well, how did that happen? Well, it started with a few activists, and they basically changed American society. This is what commercials for cigarettes used to sound like.
You know, if you were to follow a busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out, for many men of medicine, usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. And because they know what a pleasure it is to smoke a mild, good-tasting cigarette, they're particular about the brand they choose. In a repeated national survey, doctors in all branches of medicine, doctors in all parts of the country were asked, "What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?" Once again, the brand named most was Camel. Yes, according to this repeated nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Why not change to Camels for the next 30 days and see what a difference it makes in your smoking enjoyment? See how Camels agree with your throat. See how mild and good-tasting a cigarette can be.
Well, cigarettes weren't actually mild and good-tasting and helpful to everyone's health. There was a population of non-smokers that could not live with people who were smoking right next to them in airplanes and elevators and in their workspaces. What about the rights of the non-smokers? Well, they actually had those rights recognized, and it started with a few activists, and it changed America. That's a story that's told in the book, The Cigarette, A Political History, and it's written by Sarah Mylov, and she's assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. So, Sarah, why did you decide to write this book?
Well, when we think about tobacco in the 20th century, we tend to think about the overwhelming power of the major tobacco companies. And most of the literature on tobacco supports this. And, you know, that story is true, the idea that there was essentially a conspiracy waged by the major tobacco companies to, in the words of a judge, to defraud the American public. But I was interested in how tobacco fit into kind of a broader sense of the American political landscape, because it didn't ring true to me that there could be a fraud perpetrated on such a broad scale if tobacco hadn't had such a large place, a normal place in American political life.
And this was not just an argument about science?
So what I found in my research is, you know, it's in 1964 that the Surgeon General's report comes out, this famous document that is the federal government linking cigarette smoking to causing lung cancer and heart disease. And it really doesn't take hold immediately in the minds of the American people. In fact, within the year, smoking rates are up again. It wasn't actually the discovery that smoking was bad for you that turned the tide. It was work, decades of work by activists that ended up making smoking a difficult thing to do, which made smoking less frequent, which made smoking socially unacceptable. And it's in part why it is, you know, vanishing today.
And basically, there had to be an argument that was turned on its head, or a way of thought that who had the run of that space? Did it belong to smokers or did it belong to non-smokers?
Right. So what this invention of the idea of a non-smoker was really crucial. So activist groups in the 70s, they had to figure out how to make a claim that they were a category of people, that they were non-smokers, and that being non-smokers meant that they were entitled to certain treatment and expectations in public space. But non-smokers had one major thing going for them, unlike much other activism at the time, which is non-smokers have always been a numerical majority. And so when they made these arguments, it helped to kind of catalyze a way of thinking and a sense of entitlement among the vast majority of Americans who did not smoke. And in fact, maybe also amongst smokers themselves, because one truth about cigarette smoking is most people who smoke don't want to be smoking. So the non-smokers' rights movement, yeah, involved confrontation between smokers and non-smokers in public. But, you know, it also may have spurred smokers to give up the habit as well.
And then there's the issue of choice. A smoker has decided to be a smoker and to smoke, and then a non-smoker did not make that decision. It's being hoisted upon them.
Yeah, so that was another argument that non-smokers had going for them. Their goal was to invert the argument of consent. And this notion of consent had really been the guiding principle of cigarette regulation ever since the Congress decided to put a warning label on the side of cigarette packs. That warning label said, caution, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health. May got watered, was the result of watering down by a pro-tobacco Congress when it was passed in 1965. The non-smokers' rights movement said, we don't care about that. The notion of consent is not applicable here because your cigarette is bothering me. So the fact that you have consented to smoke is irrelevant to the discussion that we should be having. And they were very effective at shifting the public debate onto that terrain.
So Sarah Mylov, author of The Cigarette, A Political History, tell me more about how some activists were able to take back the space and claim that their rights had to be respected. And it used to be, you know, you go to work, everyone was smoking. It was everywhere. Even now when you watch some old TV shows like Barney Miller, you know, they're smoking in the precinct. And now that can't happen anymore. How did that change happen?
That world is gone. Yeah. So this change really is part of the activism of the late 1960s and early 1970s. And one of the primary groups responsible for this was called GASP, Group Against Smokers Pollution. It's also a high point for, you know, punny acronym groups. And this group was started by a woman named Clara Gowen, who, in her own words, was a housewife in College Park, Maryland. And she was the mother of two young girls, one of whom had a severe tobacco allergy and could not go out, which prevented the family from going out to dinner. So Gowen and her friends basically got together and they launched what I think you can think of as their first political action. They said, we're going to take away the ashtrays from our own homes. And when I heard this story and read about this, I thought, like that this small act required premeditation and group solidarity to me suggested what an uphill battle these women thought that these women were facing, right? That they had to basically declare their homes non-smoking, even though they themselves did not smoke. And so what Gowen decides to do is basically start an organization. And she uses the mimeograph machine of the local lung association to print basically a newsletter that then gets sent to hundreds of lung associations across the country. And basically the first chapters of GASP are born. And the goal of this group was not to get people to stop smoking. It was to get people to stop smoking in public. That was the real innovation of the non-smokers' rights movement.
And there was also Donna Simp, who worked at the phone company, and her workspace was a smoke-filled room.
Absolutely. So one really interesting dimension to these early anti-tobacco activist groups is that they're frequently led by women, and this was the case for Donna Shemp, who was a customer service representative at New Jersey Bell Telephone, and she had a horrible tobacco allergy, such that every morning she would pop an anti-emetic pill because she might vomit at work from tobacco. She would sometimes wear a gas mask at work, which she would lower but not remove when she needed to speak to customers who came into the office. And she had been evaluated by a company doctor who told her, you need to go home. You shouldn't work in such a smoky environment. And she basically thought, okay, I'll go home and my supervisors will figure out how to rearrange the desk so I'm not so exposed to smoke. But she was at home for, she thought, a few days. few days turn into weeks, weeks turn into months. And during that time, the company really revealed itself to be quite opposed to offering a non-smoking policy to give Shemp any relief. And so she decided to sue New Jersey Bell. And she won her case, which was the first time that a non-smoker had ever found a right to a smoke-free work environment as part of a employer's right to offer an employee a safe and healthy work space.
So it used to be commonplace people could smoke at work, and if you didn't, if you were a non-smoker, that was just too bad. And what about the, was there any concern at all about the issue of secondhand smoke?
So what's very interesting with these early activists is they understood themselves to be irritated and sickened by secondhand smoke, what we now call secondhand smoke. They sometimes called it passive smoking. But their claims for why people should stop smoking in public did not entirely center around the medical case. They were basically asserting kind of a civic right. Basically, their argument was non-smokers are the numerical majority. Why should we be subjected to the habits of smokers? It doesn't, it's not fair. It doesn't make sense. And so the like kind of hard scientific epidemiological evidence for the harms of secondhand smoke don't actually come about for several more years, but they have already started to secure successes, getting a smoke-free workplace policy or smoking restrictions at work, or as was the case with gas, petitioning and winning laws from local governments to restrict smoking in municipal facilities and public spaces in cities across the United States.
So non-smokers were able to present themselves basically as an oppressed class.
They very much piggybacked on some of the language of the civil rights movement. They would make arguments that, you know, the presence of secondhand smoke, ambient tobacco smoke, meant that, for example, I cannot enjoy my lunch at a lunch counter, so it's as if I'm being denied seating at a lunch counter. They use the arguments in a way and the techniques also of the feminist movement, that they engaged in a kind of consciousness raising, that a private indignity, the private experience of being subjected to somebody else's tobacco smoke and that feeling that you wanted to speak out but you couldn't, they made that public and they made that a part of their politics. And they also were really influenced by the environmental movement of the time. First Earth Day was 1970, and so a lot of the discussion about tobacco smoke is also coming out of the idea that if cigarette smoke had been coming out of a smokestack, parts... particulate matter in it would be regulated. So why can't non-smokers get some relief for these chemicals that
sure.
are harmful?
Just like GASP is groups against smoking pollution, they call
pollution.
Themselves.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we want to talk about how small government, city governments led the way in bringing about this change. What does it mean? What are the comparisons to some of the debates that we're having now, particularly when it comes to things like climate change, and even guns in public spaces? What are the parallels and what are the lessons learned by both sides of the argument? You can call in. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Sarah Milev. Her book is The Cigarette, A Political History. It's a different look at the rise and fall of the cigarette as through the lens of politics. Here's one politician, South Carolina Senator Kerr Scott, talking about the importance of tobacco.
Friends, this is Kerr Scott. This program is on tobacco. We in North Carolina are concerned, and rightly so, over the plight of the tobacco industry. The industry is in a revolution. This revolution was set off by the lung cancer scare. I mean talk of cigarettes causing cancer. The cancer scare made people go to filter cigarettes. Right or wrong, this has compelled farmers to make drastic changes in the kind of tobacco they grow. Since the days of Sir Walter Raleigh, tobacco has been North Carolina's number one crop. It has been and still is the backbone of our farm economy.
Sarah Milov, can you talk about how instrumental the government was in propping up tobacco growers?
Yeah, that's a perfect clip for this question. Beginning in the 1930s, the federal government, that is, instituted a rigorous and far-reaching subsidy program for different types of tobacco, but most importantly, the type of tobacco that filled what was called an American-style cigarette. This is called flue-cured tobacco, and it's grown in the Carolinas, Virginia, Georgia, and parts of Florida. And under this system, farmers had to restrict how much tobacco they could produce, but in exchange, they were guaranteed a minimum price on their tobacco. And this program lasted far longer than many other government subsidy programs.
Let me make clear that this was the Depression. There was lots of programs just like this, but as the economy recovered, they were able to be phased out, but not for tobacco.
Right. This type of supply management was in effect for other crops, to be sure. But tobacco, even during the Depression, was written under separate farm legislation than even the main farm bill, and tobacco farmers received a relatively greater amount of money for what they produced.
Tobacco was propped up. It was a part of the government, well entrenched. They had senators who were able to prevent anything from, like Jesse Helms also, who were able to keep tobacco and smoking alive in America. And it took a political movement founded by activists to take that on. And it really started in cities. Why were cities so important?
Well, in part, it had to do with the power of tobacco in Congress. So these activists, women like Clara Gowan, saw that they were not going to make inroads into changing the regulatory structure of tobacco if you went through the Congress. And so what activists realized was the levers of power that were closest to them may, in fact, have the greatest effect. And so because the goal of the non-smokers' rights movement was not to get masses of Americans to quit smoking outright, it was to get Americans to quit smoking in public, to quit smoking around non-smokers, the non-smokers' rights movement found itself quite successful at passing local ordinances that restricted where people could smoke, which then had the effect of maybe creating more non-smokers that further demanded more changes. So it was a movement that built upon itself by acting locally first.
Let me go to a caller. This is Lee. And Lee, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Yeah, I remember those times because I used to take the bus from the Woodlawn area to downtown to where I worked. And there was this one guy who got on the bus right after me, and he lit up a cigarette and he filled the entire bus with smoke. And I asked him several times on these rides to please not smoke because I'm very sensitive to it. And he said no. And finally, on about the 10th time that this happened, I said, please stop smoking. I said, you can live for 30 minutes without a cigarette, but I cannot be healthy for the rest of the day after inhaling all your smoke. And the bus driver said to me, lady, there's no law against smoking. If you don't like it, you can get off the bus. So I got off the bus, and I was late to work, and I was very angry. And I called up some of my friends, and we got together. We were all non-smokers. And we visited a city council person, and we told her the problem. And she said, well, yeah, that's not too good. I don't smoke either. I said, we're not asking people not to smoke. We're just asking them not to smoke in enclosed places like a city bus.
Right. Lee, thank you so much. That's a great example, Sarah Milov, similar to what you write about.
Exactly. Those dynamics are so familiar from my research. And one kind of technique of the non-smokers' rights movement, like Lee described, was wanting to avoid at all costs, really, well, maybe not at all costs, but wanting to avoid for as long as possible that confrontation between smoker and non-smoker, because though non-smokers were always the numerical majority in the United States, which I think is something that we can forget when we look back through, you know, the gauze of Hollywood, which was very much aligned with the tobacco industry. But non-smokers still wanted to avoid the confrontation with smokers. And so a big part of the non-smokers' rights movement was kind of through a visual vernacular of anti-smoking. And so you'd see them wearing all sorts of buttons that would say kind of funny slogans like, you know, kiss a non-smoker, taste the difference, or your cigarette is killing me. But it was kind of a funny way of preempting the kind of confrontation that Lee had to have on the bus.
So we have political arguments today. They seem to follow a parallel path. And one of them, people might think this is a huge stretch, but guns in public spaces. So who has the right, whose right reigns supreme? The person who doesn't want to be around guns or the person who wants to pack their weapons in public? And how is that being shaped by this argument?
Yeah, there's a lot of different lessons from the non-smokers' rights movement. With regards to guns, one striking parallel that I've seen is the potential role of private businesses and workplaces as serving as kinds of regulators. So a number of stores are requesting, for example, that their customers not open carry, even in states where it is legal. And you see a similar kind of visual vernacular emerging. Just like the no smoking sign, there are, you know, stores with stickers that basically say no guns in the store, which I think, too, has kind of a consciousness-raising function to make people realize that, you know, space can be taken for people who don't want to see guns around, that they can make a claim to space as well.
And we talk about climate change. Well, the Heartland Institute was a think tank, so-called think tank, that was very much in favor of protecting smokers' rights and arguing that tobacco did not cause cancer and that nicotine was not addictive. And now they've become a leading advocate saying that climate change is a hoax and that the science is not settled. So we're seeing many of the same actors and tactics used again.
Yeah, absolutely. The arguments for climate change denialism are directly out of the tobacco playbook, to say the science isn't settled. And the reason it's not settled is because both the tobacco and the fossil fuel industry pay scientists to unsettle the science, right? So it's a total kind of mercenary argument. But the tobacco playbook runs both ways. So in the case of climate change, I think climate activists have also learned the lessons of whether or not they knew it, of anti-tobacco activists. So after the United States pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, you know, you saw initiative from a number of large American cities saying, we're going to hold ourselves to these standards. So I think what it shows is that within the American system, there are still opportunities to make meaningful change and find meaningful regulation on large issues. It might not be as desirable as federal action, particularly on the issue of climate change, but it's significant in that it can continue to stoke social activism in order to demand those changes later.
Now, these issues that we talk about now with guns and also with climate change is a partisan issue. One party really has taken one side and the other party has taken the other. Cigarette, was that a partisan issue? Mm-hmm.
That is, I'm really glad you asked that. That's a pretty significant difference from the 1970s story and the climate change and the gun story. The political parties at the time were less ideologically sorted, so that to be a Democrat did not necessarily mean you were a liberal, and certainly not necessarily a liberal on issues that had to do with, say, agricultural supports. And to be a Republican didn't necessarily mean that you were opposed to all government regulation. So within the cigarette issue, you see people working across the aisle, especially at the local level, to try to restrict smoking.
Smoking has taken on a different form now. It's called vaping and e-cigarettes. Is that following a similar cycle?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about vaping, it's always important to remember that Juul, which has the lion's share of the market, actually is Big Tobacco. Altria has a 35% stake in Juul. Altria is just the new name for Philip Morris. And what's interesting about the rise of the vaping issue is the real success of the non-smokers' rights movement was eradicating the social acceptability of smoking. You know, it's now kind of shocking to see somebody smoking. You wonder when you see somebody smoking near a building, are they allowed to do that here, right?
Right.
But what's happened with vaping is the rise of a new, a subculture, a youth subculture, where vaping is acceptable, and indeed it is part of it. It is the culture, and
right.
So I think many people in public health fear a repetition of the once again the acceptability of bringing, you know.
Exactly. So we're out of time. I want to thank Sarah Mylove for her book, The Cigarette: A Political History. Thanks for joining us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.